From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Last time I had these folks on the show, this book was not out yet, but I want you all to rush to the show notes or rush to your local bookstore or online book service and buy From Crime Scene to Courtroom, Examining the Mysteries Behind Famous Cases. Of course, the authors are forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht and Donna Kaufman. Nice to have you back on the show.
Good to be with you. Thanks for inviting us.
Always a pleasure. I want to start, Dr. Wecht, with you. And, of course, you talk about Michael Jackson in the book. Conrad Murray, convicted, not a big surprise to anyone, not yet sentenced. But your thoughts on the trial and the conviction?
Well, I was not the least bit surprised. I predicted that he would be convicted. I would have been shocked almost as much as I was by the Casey Anthony verdict if he had not been convicted. And as I said, I think he was very fortunate to have had only involuntary manslaughter charges brought against him. I think it could very easily have been second-degree murder. So no surprise, I think the jury considered everything. It was a well-presented case by the prosecution. The evidence was very, very clear to use those drugs in a home setting and then to follow through inadequately, incompetently, as he did. What more need be said?
A jail sentence, or are we looking at probation here?
If I were the judge, I would sentence him to 50 or 60 hours a week of providing medical care under supervision and a kind of a medical outpatient clinic in a poor section of town. I would take advantage. He is a doctor.
Yeah.
Nobody ever said he's totally inadequate in providing just basic medical care. That's what I would do. I don't see any sense in sending him just to jail to languish there. I would make use of his medical training and provide some particular medical care to the community, which certainly could use it, I'm sure, in certain locales.
Absolutely. Dr. Cyril Wecht and Donna Kaufman are here. Donna Kaufman, the story of Michael Jackson, the Conrad Murray trial, not yet over, but soon to be over. Of course, you write about it in Crime Scene to Courtroom. But was this as compelling of a trial as, say, Anthony or what we may see with Drew Peterson?
Well, Drew hasn't gone to court yet. He's still in jail waiting trial, so we'll have to see how that one plays out. It's always a huge impact on the community whenever one of these mega trials happens, and this was happening downtown Los Angeles, so I was able to go down there and witness for myself the scene. There were a lot of Michael Jackson supporters with signs and being very vocal. And there were a couple of, there were several Dr. Murray supporters. So it does impact the community. I don't think anything in recent times has the impact of the Casey Anthony case, which we also write about in the book. That was just a massive outpouring of community concern and anger at the verdict. And, she still is underground. I don't think she'll ever be able to show her face.
Dr. Wecht, with Dr. Murray, going back to 1977 with Elvis and many other celebrity cases, I know I've asked you this before, but I'd like you to comment on it again. Will we see now a different perspective when it comes to celebrities and, for lack of a better term, the doctor shopping that they sometimes do?
I think for a while it will have a dampening effect, but ultimately I think you'll have a reversion back to a situation in which physicians, as well as other kinds of people, but physicians, because of the special care they're able to provide and the prescriptions they're able to write, who will be sucking up to celebrities, some of them because of money, most of them because of the vicarious thrill being associated with major figures, being able to boast about it to family and friends and acquaintances, and be a special guest at a cocktail party, and so on. You're going to have that. It's been around for a long time, and sooner or later, somebody starts off like that, thinking that he's going to provide good medical care, and he's going to get sucked in, because you're going to reach a point, either he is a physician who provides medical care and exercises a strong judgment and a firm hand, or he moves along with the tide, not wanting to be discharged. So, I don't think that it is going to be a major revolution. Look at all the cases that we've had, as you just said, Dana, going back all the way to Elvis Presley, and what happened with Dr. Nicopoulos, good old Dr. Nick. Did it change anything from Elvis Presley's death up until Conrad Murray? You're talking about, 30, 40 years.
Yep.
So if it did not change then, I doubt that it's going to change in the future.
Absolutely. Donna Kaufman.
Especially, the medical boards are really slow about even taking away the licenses of these doctors when there's just over-medication, not even a death.
You know, I want to continue on. We're talking to Donna Kaufman and Cyril Wecht about their new book, From Crime Scene to Courtroom. Click on the link in the show notes to pick it up from Amazon.com or your favorite book provider. Probably one of the, a couple of the most listened to shows that I've done in the last 13 years, but probably two of the most hated shows that I got the most hate mail from were my interviews with Drew Peterson. Dr. Wecht, let's talk about Drew Peterson. That's a case. The story has not yet been totally told.
Well, Drew Peterson is his own worst enemy.
Yeah.
I will never be able to prove this. I think that if he had kept his mouth shut, lived not in total seclusion, but a quiet life, and said nothing, that the odds are very strong that nothing would have ever happened. He just almost set out to invite disaster, to dare people to come after him. It was almost as if he was on a mission to destroy himself. Incredible. So how it will play out, I don't know. Don't forget, no charges have been filed against him for his missing fourth wife, and Stacey Peterson. And I think that if he is convicted in the Savio case, it is very likely that if they want to bother, but of course if it's a life sentence and he's already not a young man, they may not. If he is acquitted, then they may still file charges against him, even though the body of Stacey Peterson hasn't been found. And I'm sure since it has not been found thus far, it won't be. And of course, so good to remind your listeners, as you know so well, Dana, that you don't need the corpus delicti, as you always did up until about a half a century ago under Old English common law. If you did not have the body, you could not proceed with a murder trial. But in America now, we've had quite a few cases in which the body was never recovered, and there have been successful convictions. So he's still got that hanging over him. As far as the Savio case is concerned, you know, I've been involved in that case. I've reviewed everything and so on. It's not one-sided. And as you know, don't forget, they did have a full-blown coroner's inquest the first time around. The pathologist of the autopsy testified. The state police handled it. It wasn't handled by his buddies in the local police force and so on. And the jury acquitted him. So, you know, I mean, there's reason to have doubt. It's just not an open and shut case by any means, and I just can't help but wonder to what extent, I'm not speaking in his favor or in his defense, but to be objective about this, I just wonder how much of the strong case that has been brought against him and the overriding of the original pathologist by others and so on, how much of that at the conscious and subconscious level has been engendered by the antipathy that continued to grow because of his conduct and his smart-ass remarks and almost, in your face kind of attitude.
Absolutely. Donna Kaufman. Drew Peterson is a dream, I guess, for an author. He wants as much attention as he can. His attorney, Joel Brodsky, told me personally on this program several times that he wants as much media as he can. He's going to use a OJ style type defense, as much publicity as he can. I agree with Dr. Wecht. If Drew had kept his mouth shut, who knows? But your thoughts on Drew Peterson?
Well, I think what will happen in the Savio case, which we get into in the book, and this is also pertains to the Jackson case and the Anna Nicole case, where the two doctors and her lawyer were acquitted of any charges of over-medicating her. It's all what the judge allows the jury to hear. In the Savio case, the judge has already limited to a serious degree some of the stuff that will eventually be given to the jury if this goes to trial. And that includes some of the letters that the victim wrote that said, he's going to kill me, he threatens to kill me. Well, it's her handwriting, it's reports that she gave to the police, but whether the judge will allow them in or of a sufficient number of them in is a good question. In the Anna Nicole case, they had that clown video that Howard K. Stern shot of Anna when she was pregnant and very, very drugged out. The judge there said, no, jury can't see it, it's prejudicial. In the Jackson case, there were two audio recordings of Jackson sounding completely drugged out, and the judge allowed those in, and he was convicted. These are, in all three cases, the victims crying out from the grave, talking to the jury. And, so it comes down to, are they allowed in, and did the judge make the right decision?
Dr. Wack, Donna makes a good comment when she says crying out from the grave. And when you look at the Anthony case and Kaylee Marie Anthony and the crying out that the public made with this acquittal, we're hearing now from the prosecutor doing a book tour, Jeff Ashton. But forensics aside, in the Anthony case, it was something that kind of set the whole jury system back on its heels, or am I wrong?
Well, I agree with you completely. I've said this was a jury from a distant planet. We were out of the country at the time, Norway with my family, and when I read the verdict, I was sure that they had translated it to English incorrectly. I just could not believe that verdict. I still find myself disbelieving it as if I am involved with a bad dream. I don't know. It's one of those things. I have likened it to one of those phenomena that occur, a meteorological or a psychological or a physical thing. Somebody says, my God, this has never happened before. There's always something that happens for the first time, right?
Right.
And this is, for the first time. I mean, who in the world would have predicted this? Unbelievable. I read a brief write-up today. Someone sent me on Ashton's book, and boy, he comes on real strong. And I like some of the comments that he made about the defense and about Baez, too, because that's my take on Jose Baez, too. I must say what Ashton has said about him. So, by the way, let me ask you, I thought that the jurors were going to be identified. Has that ever happened? Or are they all moved to South America?
Yeah, I don't know if they've moved to South America. And I thought they were going to be identified too and try to get their 15 seconds of fame. But it's hard to say, Donna Kaufman, when you look at this case. I can remember early on in the case interviewing Cindy Anthony on my program. And I've listened to the audio several times. And when she's talking about looking for her missing granddaughter, she's talking about how her daughter can't be held culpable. Who talks like that unless you have an idea what's going on?
Right. Well, exactly. That the great divide in that family is that George, who was a former detective, knew exactly what happened and just didn't want to believe it. But Cindy also certainly knew, because her actions to cover up for her daughter could only have come from somebody who was fully aware of what happened and just made the decision that she wasn't going to give her sympathy to the child who was the innocent child who was dead, but to the guilty child who was still alive. And you know, as long as she was willing to, I believe, perjure herself, she got caught, and the jury let her go. You know, no one was ever going to charge her with perjury, so she got away with it.
Family
secrets in that household are just the things that, you know, primetime soap operas are made of.
It's interesting, and you covered in your book, you know, with the Brian Jones case, for example, the difference between what's called an accident, and I guess a Savio too, and to what really happened, Dr. Weck. Maybe if you could share with my audience a little bit from the forensic perspective, you know, drowning in a bathtub is one thing, but being drowned in a bathtub is another thing, and let's get into the Brian Jones case a little bit.
Well, there's no question. Drowning cases are difficult to diagnose, and they are, to a great extent, a diagnosis of exclusion and one of circumstances. You have to rule out everything else, and I mean everything else. Any kind of foul play, anything that suggests some kind of physical involvement, and then, of course, drugs, etc. And then you have to know something about the body being in water, near water, whether it be a an ocean, a lake, a river, or your bathtub. So it's not a definitive diagnosis. We really don't have, by the way, a specific pathological test. It was started sometime in the past. The difference in specific gravity or in the sodium level of the blood in the right side of the heart and the left side of the heart, that has been disproven. So then later on, it was thought that if you found diatoms, these are minuscule sub-microscopic particles that are found in the water, you could prove there was, and that has been proven. So you should know that there is no specific test to prove. The absence of water can be accounted for by laryngospasm, which clamps down the epiglottis and prevents water from going in. The finding of water in the stomach does not mean that the person drowned, because water can get in after the body's been there. So it's a very difficult diagnosis. And you know, back to then the whether it's Savio or Brian Jones, you've got to take every single thing into account. And then insofar as whether or not a drowning, if it is death by drowning, was accidental or homicidal, or even suicidal in a larger body of water, it's not likely that it's going to occur in a bathtub. But
may I just remind listeners that he was the Rolling Stones founder and original guitarist who died in his swimming pool in England in 1969, and since then, lots and lots of people have changed their stories about what happened and pointed fingers and saying, he was murdered by this guy. No, he was murdered by that guy. And you know, so the question to Dr. Wecht was it a murder or was it suicide or something else?
Right, absolutely. Donna Kaufman and Cyril Wecht are here talking about their new book, From Crime Scene to Courtroom, examining the mysteries behind famous cases like Michael Jackson, Casey Anthony, Drew Peterson, Brian Jones, and much, much more. Dr. Wecht, you know, when we look at all the cases that are before us right now, the high-profileness, you name it, it's going to be something more tomorrow, something more the next day. You'll be called out maybe tonight. It's hard to say. Why is the public so fascinated with these sorts of stories?
Well, I think news media are to blame or to get the credit, depending on how you want to look at it. Obviously, before there was television, then, you know, how much could you possibly disseminate by way of information? And even today, when you talk about these famous cases, you know, I get five newspapers every day, minus one on the weekend. New York Times, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, and then two very significant papers here in Pittsburgh. And many times in these cases, if you look at television, my God, from one show to another, you'd think that there's nothing else happening in the world. Forget about Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq and the Mideast and the economic crisis and even the political scene. When you read your five newspapers the next morning, you're lucky if you find two sentences about many of these cases. So it's the kind of news media, it's the excitement, it's the glamour, it's the showmanship, and then tied in, of course, with what has happened in the world of forensic science in the past several years, DNA, and then all of the CSI television programs and so on. You put that all together, and you've got a public that is absolutely fascinated by these cases. It's just incredible. And they want the visualization of it, though, is a point that I was making, too. To read about it in a detached, calm, objective, detailed fashion, yeah, there are many people that'll do that, but most people, man, they want to see it on their television screen, and they want to see somebody, being manacled and walked in. They want to see the dead person before he or she was killed, and if they can see a picture of a dead body, that's even better, and so on. So, you know, it's a carnival. It's a show.
Absolutely. Donna Kaufman, I'll give you the final word. I always ask authors this on the program when I have their book in front of me and I'm holding it up for the television camera right now, From Crime Scene to Courtroom. When I'm going through the bookstore and I pick up your book and I look at it and I look at the nice glossy cover, I'm fascinated with the stories. What about that book will make me not want to put it down?
Well, I think that I'm lucky to work with the... he makes me say one of the most phenomenal medical detectives of all time, but I don't say one of. He is. This is the guy. And his take on these cases, we've picked seven cases that are vastly different in causes of death and manner of death, and they're twisty cases. He's done 54,000 cases. So we've picked seven of the ones that are the juiciest and the most just full of mystery. So anybody who reads novels and likes mystery novels, this is the real thing. This is no fiction here. This is, it is as real as a heart attack. And they're also high profile, some of them, and others are not. And who knows what will make a case resonate with an individual. But we've tried to pick ones that are very, very different sets of circumstances and characters and parts of the country. And so I think there's something for everyone there. And, I like it. It's my favorite book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know what? It's one of my favorites, too. Cyril Weck, Donna Kaufman. The book is From Crime Scene to Courtroom, Examining the Mysteries Behind Famous Cases. Click on the link in the show notes on how to pick it up. As always, folks, thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Dana. It's very gracious of you to have us, and wish you and your listeners and viewers a very wonderful Thanksgiving holiday.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Thanks.
Yes, and to all the scared monkeys, keep doing what you're doing. You're just wonderful.
Thanks, Don.
Great sleuth out there.
Thanks, Donna. Take care.
Thanks. Good night.
Bye-bye. That's Donna Kaufman and Dr. Cyril Wecht. Famed forensic pathologist, Dr. Cyril Wecht. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with Pat Brown, criminal profiler Pat Brown, and we're going to talk about the Penn State matter, what's going on there, how crazy that is, and a little bit about Conrad Murray. And then after that, a local case for those of you listening in Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, or anywhere you'd be fascinated on it. We're going to try and help find James Joseph Gallagher, who's missing from my neck of the woods in Saskatchewan. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back. You all know criminal profiler Pat Brown, one of the busiest people in the crime beat. In fact, I think she was doing some TV tonight, weren't you, Pat?
Well, actually, we taped earlier, so
you taped.
I wasn't actually on up until the last minute here.
See, I had this joke all planned that I was going to introduce you as now the new speechwriter for Rick Perry, but...
Well, that's an idea.
I didn't know if I was going to do that or not. Poor Rick Perry. You know, we all have brain freezes, but that certainly wasn't the time to do it. But I didn't bring you on to talk about politics. I want to talk a little bit about Conrad Murray, and then we'll get into this disaster at Penn State.
Which is another brain freeze.
Oh, absolutely. Are you shocked at I know your answer, but are you shocked at the conviction of Conrad Murray? And I guess my question is, will he go to jail?
Well, I'm not shocked at the conviction. I mean, he should have been convicted. I mean, essentially, this is a drug dealer.
Yeah.
This is a man who was professed to be a man of medicine, who is to be trusted. He's got a license for it. He's taken an oath. And he's supposed to look after the best health and welfare of his patient, which he clearly did not, because he provided drugs for him that he shouldn't be taking, and obviously did him in. And he needed to be convicted. And, you know, clearly, you know, I know what happens in these cases. A guy like him, you know, Michael Jackson brings him on in. I mean, it's a heck of a lot of money, and it's exciting to be around all that fame. And, you know, sometimes you just do the bidding of whoever pays your bills and gives you the excitement. But so he was bought, essentially. But, you know, that's a ethical and moral decision he made, and he's going to pay for it. Well, maybe not. As you point out, will he go to jail? And I'm a little concerned that he's just going to, you know, he's losing his medical license. Well, you know, but bye-bye, you can go on, or you can stay at home and, you know, live in your fancy house and under house arrest for a while, like Martha, and then go on your way. And I think that's kind of making a mockery out of what he did.
Well, you know, consequences aside, I guess some will say that he is the fall guy, not me. I'm curious what Pat Brown says.
He's the fall guy?
Yeah.
I'm missing the point there.
The fall guy for all the other doctors that were giving Michael Jackson drugs to.
Who was there that night? Oh, him.
Yeah,
okay. I mean, he is overseeing it. This is a patient he's on a, you know, one-to-one basis with. Yes, it's possible Michael Jackson's, you know, slithering around getting other drugs. That happens. But he has no business giving the drug himself. So I just, you know, you can blame everybody else in the world, but he was there.
Yeah. He's the only one in the room, and I agree. This fall guy.
He gave him it, you know, and that drug should never have been given to Michael Jackson.
The fall guy stuff is nonsense. But I guess it goes to the other question, though. We've seen lots of celebrities with this, I'll use the term doctor shopping aspect. Will this case do anything for that, or will we hear about another celebrity or famous person 6 months from now or a year from now?
Yeah, I'd say we'd hear it again. I think it's just, unfortunately, money makes people go crazy, and so does celebrity. I think those things, too, put together almost like drugs for anybody. You know, they want to be around that kind of thing, that kind of lifestyle, which, you know, they don't have, even though they might have a very good lifestyle, because certainly if you're a doctor of any, you know, with any reasonable practice, you're certainly not living under a bridge. But it just that level of lifestyle, I think too many people are, yes, you know, easily to be sucked into that. And then if they don't do their diligent duty as to what they should be doing for their profession, well, you know, don't want to give up what they've got, and they got a client there. The client says, "This is what I want. You don't want to give it to me, you're gone." And by that time, you like your life. So, you know, you sell your soul to the devil, and that's, you got to pay the price if you you're taking that kind of a risk.
Absolutely. Pat Brown is here, criminal profiler Pat Brown. Click on the link in the show notes to learn more about her. All right, Penn State. It just seems like every time we turn the TV on or look in the papers, there's another sickening story out there. We can do a whole show on pedophilia, but let's talk about Penn State. Your thoughts on this Sandusky character. The goofball actually went to the media and is talking about admitting to showering with the young boy. Big mistake on his part, but so let's talk about this.
Well, you know, I don't know what his lawyer was thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, good God almighty. I mean, he had no reason to have to go to the media at this point. You know, he could simply stick to his story, whatever it might have been. But apparently he didn't work that out terribly well with his lawyer. And he goes out there, and my God, he completely destroyed himself in that interview. And I was watching when, I forgot who the guy was doing the interview with him, but the look on his face.
Yeah,
and as he was talking, you could just look like, I can't believe he's saying this.
Yeah.
And I think the first part I saw was when he asked the question, are you sexually attracted to underage boys? And Sandusky answered, Am I sexually attracted to underage boys? Sexually attracted? That there is a classic sign that you're about to lie because you don't have the right answer, which should be no.
Yeah.
You know, because your answer is probably yes, and you're going, so you repeat the question, and he did it twice.
You know,
trying to buy himself time to come up with what he's going to say. And right there, you think, wow, you can't even answer that straight. But it gets worse.
Yeah.
And the one that I just really blew me away after he screwed that one up, this is what really cracked me up. He said, and I didn't go around seeking out every young person for sexual needs. Wait a minute. Think about that. I didn't go around seeking out every young person, but clearly I sought some out.
Oh,
and he goes on to say, there are many that I didn't have.
But
you had some of them, huh?
Yeah. My God.
I just can't. I mean, that's three confessions in a few sentences.
Yeah, exactly. The interviewer was... The interviewer was Bob Costas, and when you look at this case, and we talk about, I looked at the body language, like the verbal responses were you know enough. We're laughing, but it's not funny. It's almost pathetic. But let's talk about the profile of a pedophile, and you know, do they know that they're doing wrong, or do they accept?
Well, of course, I do.
Do they
know exactly what they're doing? They're very manipulative people, and he planned this whole thing out to have this organization where he could then, you know, seek out what he wanted. You know, he's very, very aware of what he's doing, but he's learned the trick of trying to play down and trying to explain away things. And of course, when you're a pedophile, you're a psychopathic. And one of the things psychopaths don't understand sometimes is that when you say certain things, the rest of the world does not take it the same way. Like, it is not okay to be showering naked with children. Where did you ever get that idea that it was okay? Or to touch their legs. That really was very creepy. I can't think of one man who thinks it's okay to go around touching boys' legs, except for pedophiles.
Right.
And then, you know, or the common one you see with pedophiles is, now, let me give you a back rub. Well, there is no man out there who's given other, you know, young teenage boys or children or even other men most of the time who are, you know, if it's not a sexual thing. And where they would think that they could get away with saying that's okay because it just means I'm being friendly and I'm giving them some comfort, and they try to explain something and the rest of us are going, that's just not right. But you know, when they're caught in the act, they have to go to they have to admit to something, so they admit to something they think isn't as bad, but it still gives everybody the creeps. Or it should have given a lot more people the creeps a lot earlier, but clearly, because of his relationship with the university and, you know, being buddies with people, they had a real hard time, you know, deciding that they should do something about it, which is pretty appalling.
Well, that's the interesting part about this is the public reaction, the media's reaction. Some were saying that the poor football team, not talking about the poor victims. The other ones are saying that, you know, the victims, there's riots, there's presidents of university being fired. The assistant coach that came across this alleged act, I guess, is now saying he did try to stop it. I've seen some media reports.
Excuse me. I'm sorry, but the only label I can come up with is the POS.
Yeah.
That was the thing that got me first, because, you know, as I was starting to hear little bits about this, I think I did the first radio interview on this, and I had only heard about it for like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I was being a little cautious about what I said, and then when I heard the rest of it, I thought, oh my God, I probably sound like an ass, because I didn't hear the rest of it. But first of all, what grown man?
Exactly.
See, I can understand if you just saw him kind of doing horseplay, but you actually saw him in the act of anally raping a 10-year-old child.
Yep.
Who can't be sitting there going, this is fun. So he sees a child in torment being sexually assaulted in the worst way by an adult, and he walks out of the room.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that's a POS.
Yep.
There is no excuse on God's earth why you didn't go in there and punch that son of a gun in the face.
Yep.
And call the police directly. He goes, calls Daddy, and Daddy tells him to come on home, and then they wait a day to go on in and have a chit-chat with the boss. What kind of crap is that? And then, when you get to Paterno on that, the thing right there, he should have looked him in the eye and said, look, you got two choices right now. You go to the police. If you're telling me the truth that you saw him raping this kid, you go to the police ASAP, or I'm firing you because you're lying about somebody in the most horrible way possible. Which one is it? But that didn't happen, did it? He neither went to the police, nor was he fired. So then you said, now I'm getting real suspicious. And then we find out that there was the 1998 incident, what they were aware of. And it's like, oh, what? Yeah, two incidents are exactly similar. You know, this lightning is striking all over the place, and you just don't do anything about it?
Yeah, and we'll...
That's why they're all going down, because they deserve to.
We'll let the audience figure out what POS means, but I think we can all figure that out. And you nailed that right on the head. But let's talk a little bit about their explanations and their cover ups and their trying to protect the sports team. You know, what make people think that way when there's a child? You know, if they'd have gone in and killed him, that would have been justifiable homicide, in my opinion.
Absolutely. I mean, they were protecting what? That they're going to have to deal with some fallout that they had hired and kept around a guy who was questionable. Well, obviously, earlier on, they should have done something immediately. And the more you don't do something, of course, the bigger hole you dig, because you are doing a kind of protection thing. And sometimes is what happens, I think, with people is they are buddy buddies. You know, these are people they, you know, spend time with day in and day out. And what people don't sometimes quite understand with, you know, people who are pedophiles or psychopaths is that a good portion of their life is very normal looking to their a friend or somebody they're working with. They do things everybody else does, like enjoy sports, go and have a beer, you know, chit-chat about fun things. And it's very hard to sometimes when guys get together to look over that guy they consider their friend who's married and think to yourself, you're screwing young boys. I mean, it's just, you know, you can't even stick it in their head. So sometimes there's a tendency to just block it. This must be some stuff people misunderstood. But, I mean, it does get to be a point where it's clear you cannot walk away any longer. And just like with the Catholic Church, in the long run, you make yourself look like a criminal, which you are if you're not reporting it and turning this guy in and getting him off the street, keeping him from other children. I don't see what the problem is to say, look, we found out the guy's a creep. You know, as soon as we found out he was what he was, we took action, and we're horrified about the situation. But in every organization, you can have a pedophile. In every organization, you can have a bad guy. I mean, it's, you know, the police have bad police officers. There's teachers that are crummy. There's doctors that are rapists. You know what I mean? It's across the board. You can't keep them out of every organization. But when you find out they're there, you know, if you sit around and accept it and protect them, well, then you're no better than they are. And that's what's happened here. They've proven that.
Criminal profiler Pat Brown is here. We're talking about Penn State. There will be more victims come forward, I'm sure. There always are in cases like this. But 10 years, 5 years, 6 months, whatever, let's talk from the victim's perspective a little bit. 10 years old, 10 years ago, you're 20 now. How do you come forward in a case like this? It's got to be difficult.
Oh, God. I mean, it's a horrible situation for those poor guys to be in. I mean, they already had problems, you know, which is why they ended up in this program. And talk about kids who just got the shaft in life in more than one way.
Yep.
You know, they end up with horrible family situations, and then they end up with this big brother, essentially, organization that, you know, does things to them that are pretty horrific. And you know, they've got to have very many difficulties in their life dealing with this. One hopes that one gets, you know, the psychologist in there to work with them to say, look, you know, there is, when you were a child, unfortunately, you got the bad roll of the dice. You know, you just got the short end of the stick, and that's what happened to you. And it's not you, because what kid can have any control over that? You can't. It's impossible. So hopefully there's somebody to work with them to teach, you know, get them through this whole thing so they can move on. But I mean, it's gonna be extraordinarily difficult. I mean, there's no question about it, and they probably will have to the problems the rest of their lives, and it's pretty sad. And that's what makes me sick when I think, when you know a child has been assaulted by this man and you don't do anything about it. It's not just that child, which is terrible enough, that has been harmed for life and didn't receive justice, and didn't, you know, it's all the other children you have now aided and abetted in getting raped. and have their lives ruined. So I don't know how anybody lives with that. Once they, you know, they should be at the police station 3 seconds flat, because, you know, I couldn't go to bed thinking, well, I guess he's out raping more kids now. Hope they're okay.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I don't understand that thinking.
Yeah.
So, you know, they deserve everything that they're going to get.
Absolutely. Pat Brown, criminal profiler, as always, thank you, ma'am.
Well, thank you very much, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And always well said by Pat Brown. Criminal profiler, the Penn State case is far from being over. I'm Dana Pretzer. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back. As you know, we cover missing person cases here on the program across North America and around the world, and it always tugs at my heartstrings a little bit when we see a missing persons case in my own backyard, and I mean the province of Saskatchewan. And I want the listeners and the viewers on Channel 7 to pay close attention to the graphic, the picture of 71-year-old James Joseph Gallagher. Police are asking for the assistance of the public in locating this missing man from the White Fox, Saskatchewan area. Nipawin RCMP received a complaint on November 4th to locate 71-year-old James Joseph Gallagher. The subject was last seen on Tuesday, November 1st in Melford around 10:15. He was driving a 2004, pay attention now, red Ford Ranger with the license plate 596-GMT. That's 596-GMT. That's a Saskatchewan license plate. According to information released by the RCMP, Gallagher was asking for directions on how to return to Saskatchewan. He was wearing a plaid jacket, beige hat, and had several days beard growth. Gallagher has a speech impediment, and that's noticeable. Then he appeared to be disoriented. I have Shannon Jardine on the line, and she is Mr. Gallagher's niece. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Dana. Thanks so much for having me on here tonight.
Yeah, no problem. And so sorry about your uncle, and we'll do what we can to help find him. Let's talk about your uncle a little bit. 71 years of age. Was it normal for him to drive long distances? It's believed that he was on his way to Manitoba.
No. He sticks pretty close to home, and he's usually in bed as soon as it gets dark. But he was helping someone out from the community, and he drove them to Melfort, which is about an hour away. And it was between 10 and 11 at night on November 1st, and asked how to get back home. And then the next sighting was the next day, way up towards Overflowing River, Manitoba. He had a flat tire about 9:30 in the morning, and the people who stopped to help him said, "No, you're going in completely the wrong direction to be going towards White Fox, Saskatchewan." So he took their directions and ended up at a gas station in Mafeking, Manitoba at 10:35 in the morning. But no, to answer your question, he normally doesn't take long trips. If he has, it's always been with other family driving, or he's with them.
We're talking about James Joseph Gallagher, missing from White Fox, Saskatchewan. Again, last seen driving a 2004 red Ford Ranger with Saskatchewan license 596-GMT. You'll see a picture of James on the website and on the graphic on TV. Let's talk about James a little bit more. Shannon Jardine's here, his niece. Did he have a cell phone or any sort of debit or credit card that could be traced?
No, that's what's made this so difficult. In this day and age, if somebody had those devices, it'd be much easier to track. But no, my uncle does not have a cell phone. The only thing he has is a checkbook. And so it's been very slow in tracking him, because obviously checks, sometimes the gas station might not cash it for a long time.
Right.
And then to get that information to the bank, it's been a very slow process. But it has been helpful. We were able to track him. He went to, after Mafeking on November 2nd, he ended up being on November 3rd at about 8:30 in the morning in Lynn Lake, Manitoba. Then that same day between 5 and 6, he was in Cranberry Portage, Manitoba. And then on November 4th, at around 5 a.m., he was near Tyrrell Lake on Highway 106, which is the Flin Flon area. And then the very last sighting was November 6th between 4 and 5 a.m. at a three-way stop in Creighton, Saskatchewan. He asked for directions and was told to go down the Hanson Lake Road. so the checks have been helpful, as well as people calling in, but we're always so many days behind. And again, the last sighting being November 6th, well, that's over a week ago.
Shannon Jardine's here. We're talking about her missing uncle, James Joseph Gallagher. He's described as approximately 5'6", 140 pounds, with short gray hair and glasses. He has a significant speech impediment. What about medical conditions, medication that he may be on? Obviously, the RCMP and city police forces have notified all hospitals. Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, he does have a medical alert, and apparently he does have medication, but it's not with him. So the health regions have been notified in hospitals as well.
Have there been any air ground searches?
Yes. I know my dad and other people, our neighbors and good friends in the town, have been doing air searches. But in the last couple of days, there's been a great organized group of a ground search happening. They did the Hanson Lake Road, as well as the Candle Lake Road, Hudson Bay area. And also today and tomorrow, they'll be looking sort of in the back roads of the Flin Flon area. And the visibility has been bad for air searching, but they're hoping it will clear tomorrow for them to go up in the air again.
Again, your uncle was last seen driving a 2004 red Ford Ranger with Saskatchewan license 596 GMT. Tell us, Shannon, I believe you have a Facebook page set up also?
Yes. If you go on Facebook, there's the search function, and if you put in there missing person James Joseph Gallagher, so that's missing person James Joseph Gallagher, his missing person Facebook page will come up. And I just wanted to also point out what makes it difficult for my uncle is he does have a significant speech impediment. So if he's asking for directions, people may not understand him. But our understanding is every time he stopped, he has been asking for help and how to get home and ask for directions. But he also can't read. So if you can imagine trying to take someone's verbal directions and then not being able to read the road signs to confirm that you're even going in the right direction makes it very, very difficult.
So I remind the listeners to check out the Facebook information on Mr. Gallagher and also on our webpage at scaredmonkeys.com. And in the missing persons form, we'll also have information about James Joseph Gallagher. If you have any information, please, please, please phone your local RCMP detachment or the Nipawin RCMP at 306-862-6270, 306-862-6270. And if you happen to come across Mr. Gallagher, hang on to him. Call, use 911 and call the police. Don't let him go because he's lost, disoriented, and we have to find him. Anything else, Shannon?
I was just going to say it's hunting season, I believe, now. So if there's any hunters out there, please keep your eyes peeled for his 2004 Ford Ranger red pickup truck, Saskatchewan license plate 596 GMT. And hey, if you're a pilot too and you're flying around, maybe keep your eyes peeled as well. Anybody can help us by looking and you getting the word out to people will really help us because the trail has gone cold over a week now, so any help we can get would be greatly appreciated.
Absolutely. And as for listeners and viewers in Saskatchewan, Alberta, Manitoba, and across North America, anyone that can help, it would be appreciated. Shannon, our thoughts and prayers are with you and your family, and please stay in touch. You have my email, and I can help any way that I can. Just get a hold of me.
Thank you so much, Dana.
Okay, take care.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Again, the missing are always hard to find, but they can't be found without help from you. So, again, James Joseph Gallagher has been missing since November 1st. Look at the graphic on the webpage, or if you're watching on Access 7, you'll see the graphic there. And, again, he was last seen driving a 2004 red Ford Ranger with Saskatchewan license 596 Golf Mike Tango 596 GMT, and that's Saskatchewan plate. Make sure and call the RCMP 911. Whoever, if you come across Mr. Gallagher, and we hope for the family that he is located soon. That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. Make sure and check out our webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. We'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.